Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Well, hello, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure to have you with me. My first guest today has been with us before. It's been many years, though, so I'm looking forward to revisiting with him. He is Carl Gould. And Carl's the coach of all coaches and the mentor of all mentors, having personally trained over 7,000 people in the business, more than anyone else in the country. He's a business growth expert, author, speaker, and serial entrepreneur. And his career started by accident, when he broke his leg and dropped out of his undergraduate accounting and finance program. He needed a new path, so he turned to what he knew best, landscaping, and he scaled that business into a seven-figure business and then sold it in 1992. And now he's built 3 multi-million dollar businesses, all before age 40. Carl has mentored CEOs of some of the biggest companies out there, including Walmart, IBM, and the U.S. Army. He's also authored 3 best-selling books on business strategy and growth, most recently Biz Dev Done Right. Carl's married with 3 kids, lives in New Jersey, and co-hosts the Quit and Get Rich radio show. Carl, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again. It's good to be back.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been a while. I look back at my records. I thought that name looks familiar, and it's been about 6 years, I think, since you were last on the show.
Yeah.
Lots happened since then. You haven't been sitting still, it sounds like. Tell us about what you've been doing.
Well, we have been very busy with, and especially this last year, with everything that's been going on. You know, I mean, this has been, in my observation, the most ruthless and merciless business correction that I've seen in my career, and I started in 1985. So that would include Black Friday of 87. I haven't seen anything like this. And so it's been quite a task to help clients really understand what they need to do now in this business environment.
Yeah, and not unlike the Great Recession of 2008, which had a lot of false starts coming back. They're economic false starts. They weren't like, oh, you can't start up again. You can't start up again. You can't start up again. It wasn't quite the same, but it still had a lot of uncertainty as to, okay, when are we going to get back to, business as usual, if at all? What are you finding the biggest mistakes that entrepreneurs are making in trying to deal with all of these issues?
Well, you know, the entrepreneurs that, you know, used either COVID or the inconvenience of what was going on as a reason to close and didn't fight hard enough to stay open, I think that was a big mistake for those. Because a community remembers the people that worked hard and really pushed themselves to serve them. And so that was a very important part, I think, of getting through COVID. The other thing right now that's happening is people are saying, oh, great, okay, the economy is going to reopen and we're going to get back to, and then fill in the blank, like back the way it was or the way we did things or whatever. And there's no going back. Just like there was no pre-9/11, there's never again going to be pre-9/11 travel. Like, you're never going to get on an airplane the same way you did, you know, pre-9/11. Business is not, you know, is going to be different in the new world. So we have to embrace that what your customers are asking for now, Like, hey, can you show up after hours? I don't want you here 9 to 5 because I don't want you in my office. You know, can you wear the booties? And, you know, are you fully sanitized? And, you know, we're taking temperature checks. And, you know, can we have touchless or contact-free service and all that? That's here to stay. Those are not temporary asks. Those are full-on, full-time, going forward asks that your clients are going to have. So it would be a mistake to think that you're going to get back to normal. I know we're hearing a lot about that new normal, but it's true. We are in a new business environment that is going to carry for the next minimum 5 to 9 years.
That's a great way to put it in perspective with the 9/11 travel. And you know, it's things have changed. Those who have adapted are now finding new and sometimes better ways to do business. I was on a call the other day with a school for youngsters, and they're all virtual, but that gives them an opportunity to expand their reach, to expand the number of students that they deal with in a different way. So there are a lot of different things that business owners can be doing. What are some of the things that you would say to someone who, say, is in a restaurant type of a business, let's say, that has lost part of their business? They can't even open at capacity, even close to it. What are some of the strategies there, for instance?
Yeah. I really feel for restaurants and all things hospitality, because they're not the biggest part of the economy, but they probably have the most emotional impact on all of us, because we all love to go out. We all love to go out and eat and all. But if I'm a restaurant, here's what I'm thinking about is, think about what your core competency is. Is you're making a great meal for your customer and you're providing an experience. One of those experiences is when you come into my restaurant. But do we have to come into the restaurant? I'm not so sure, right? So can we start a meal delivery service? You know, can you be my personal chef for my house? So if you have your regular customer base, I would go to them and say, let us make, you know, family night, movie night, you know, date night at home. Let us make your meal for that day. Or for your kids, how about we make lunches for the week for the kids that are working, that are at home? What can we do for your home experience? Now, most restaurants, not all, of course, but most restaurants you can go up to, and you know, there's a curbside way to get a delivery. Well, my brother's a DJ. I know this works because he had to do it, right? Well, here's what I would do. Right outside of my restaurant, since everyone can't come in, I'd put a DJ in the parking lot. This is a real thing, by the way, because I know that he did it. But I'd put a DJ in the parking lot. I'd ask, you know, the old drive-up restaurant, have people come, and we'll serve you right in your car. Right, so you'll still get an experience. We'll beep our horn at the DJ. The DJ's going to come around. Hey, you Buick, let's hear from you. Hit your horn. Hey, you Honda, right? And so, you can make an experience there, you know. You may have heard of the digital dinners or digital happy hours, where go get your favorite beverage, you know, something to eat, bring it, get in front of the screen, and we'll all kind of gather around and talk that way. So a restaurant has a number of ways that it can still engage with its clientele. Now, there were some companies that were thinking about this beforehand, and they do have a little bit of the upper hand. But if you've been a restaurant and you've been fighting hard to service your community, bring the restaurant to your clients. By the way, that is the single largest trend in the franchising world, is bring the franchise to the customer. Don't make the customer come to you, like a food truck. Right. So there are strategies out there that are working right now. So restaurants, I love you. I love going out. We're a big eat out family. And so we're rooting hard for you guys to embrace some of these creative strategies.
Yeah, that's great. And those are good ideas. That's probably one of the hardest hit and toughest industries out there today, just because of everything that's, you know, they have to deal with, and the rules change, you know, regularly. Hopefully we'll see them all get better. You know, a lot of our listeners, Carl, are positioning for sale. What do you tell businesses that want to position their business for sale that they should be doing right now in advance, getting ready for the day that they put their business on the market?
So your intro says that, you know, we help companies that are looking at the next 3 to 10 years, and 3 would be the minimum. So if you're thinking of putting your business on the market, you have to prove that two major aspects of your business, there's a lot of things you have to prove, but two major aspects of your business you have to prove don't rely on you, the owner, and that is lead generation, and that is closing the sale. Because if I'm going to go buy your business and I find out that, you know, mom and dad who own the, or the partners or the brothers or sisters that own that business, that all the client relationships land with them, all the sales, they're generating all the leads, they're out there speaking, they're out there networking, I'm going to cut almost 50% off of your enterprise value, because I have to assume that much of your business is going to go away when you go away, when I buy the business. And so what I would be looking at right away is I would be going to my managers and I would sit them down and say, it's my goal to exit this business in the next, call it 3 to 5 to 10 years. I want you to be part of it. I want when a buyer comes through the door, I want them to know that you guys really run the business. And so I want to make you part of that day or that. So I'm going to, you know, your bone, I'll give you profit share, I'll give you bonuses, a percentage of the sale. I want you to feel like this is your exit as much as it is our exit. And so because if I'm buying the business, I want to know that your management team is really well engaged and that they are truly running the business. So I want to know that right out of the gate.
So that's really good information. A lot of business owners struggle with, I'm afraid to tell my employees that anything's going to happen. We're talking about the very best key employees of the company, right? We're not saying, going out and saying, hey, everybody, the company's for sale and you're all going to be part of it, because that can let the cat out of the bag too soon, right?
Right. Yeah. You want to wait. I'm a fan of waiting as long as you can to tell as many people as you can. And so one of the ways, even if you're not going to tell your key management that, you know, that you're planning on exiting, what you can do is just give them you just redo their compensation plan where they get rewarded for profit, how much responsibility they take. They can earn equity in the business, or they can flat out buy in if they want to, you know. So what I would do is I would just want to make them more of, whether it's the formal ownership structure or kind of the energetic ownership structure, like this is your business and we're going to motivate you and incentivize you based on the performance of the company, and as the company continues to do better, you'll do exceedingly better. So even if you're against telling them, at least redo the comp plan that makes it more performance based, so as the company does better, they do better.
Good point. Yeah, we've heard that before, called make them growth partners, right? Make your employees,
right,
Turn them into growth partners and have them get excited about the growth of the company. And a lot has been written about, you know, giving them a stake in the outcome, because a lot of these key employees out there, as you know, have been around for a long time, and they're thinking about, hey, what's in it for me if anything happens, if I give my last 10 years of hard work to this company. Those are great tips and great points.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your most recent book, Biz Dev Done Right. What inspired you to write that? What need did you see for that, and what's in the book?
Thank you. So, when I wrote the book, I was looking at the fact that a lot of people, when they're putting together their either marketing campaigns, their sales programs, I find that they get right to the finish line and then they stop it for some reason, or they sabotage it, or for some reason they're not getting all the results they want as fast as they do. So they get right to the end and they stop. And I'm like, oh my God, they're getting business development wrong. We need to help them, show them how to get it right. And so the idea was to look at what are the key mistakes that I watched companies make over the years from a sales production standpoint and a sales management standpoint, and show them strategies as to how they can do that. And so a good portion of the book is how to be the right sales manager, because business development in one sentence would be new business from new customers, you know, new verticals, new revenue lines. And so what that means is you have to, you know, you have, when you're growing your business, you go from friends selling to friends, meaning I'm out there owner operator, I do a job for a friend, you like what I do, so you refer me to one of your friends, you now become my friend, new friend, you know, that I'm doing a job for. And you have to scale your business. You have to go from friends selling to friends to strangers selling to strangers, meaning I've got to hire somebody I didn't know before. They have to go out and they get a prospect or a client I've never met before. So now I'm fulfilling an order to a stranger I've never met by a stranger who bought them in the first place. And so the book talks about how do you produce and what are some of the key things you do in order to close the sale. But there's also half the book is on sales management. How do you build the quality and performance of your sales producers? And so we just saw some mistakes being made when you started out on the right track, but you made a mistake, and all of a sudden you took a successful campaign because you didn't know any better, and you sabotaged it. And so we wanted to help people get that right and understand when things are working well and how to see it through.
And a lot's happened in the sales, certainly in the sale fulfillment world these days. There's a lot more, and especially for owners that are thinking about, you know, exiting their business, they need to automate, like you said before. Tell me how you generate a lead and close a sale, and I guess a big part of that is how is that documented? How is that done automatically, if at all possible? How is that tracked? Because a buyer is going to be looking at a buyer of the business is going to be looking at, well, how am I going to keep doing what's been being done if it's not automated somehow, or if it's in someone else's head? It's going to be impossible. So that sounds like it's a huge topic these days, especially for smaller businesses, right?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, look, because of COVID, you have to now convince your, in some cases, your loyal customers to change their behavior again and start coming out and buying from you again. And maybe even in a new way. So there's never been a more important time to understand what the needs of your prospects and clients are and market to them and sell to them in a way that meets their highest needs, because their needs now are different than they were a year ago. Some of the pain points are the same, but how you deliver to them matters now as much as ever. And so, yeah, so your selling process has come back to the forefront.
Yeah, and if you don't do it, guess what? It's already being done, because every time anybody utters a word, the phone somehow picks it up and starts showing you, exactly what you just said, right? These days, the automation of that technology is being done elsewhere. So if you're not doing it, guess what? You're gonna lose out big time. So lot has changed, and now you're also. You have a radio show called Quit and Get Rich. I'd love to hear more about that. There's an intriguing title. What do you talk about on the show, and how do people listen to that?
So thank you. So the show's on iHeartRadio, Quit and Get Rich, and also it's there's a smaller segment within the show called Fix It in Five, where we fix any problem in your business in 5 minutes or less. And it's a great little segment, and it's also become its own spin-off show on iHeartRadio. So go ahead and check out. We've got about 300 episodes on there. And it's an offbeat way, our take on what's going on in the business world and how to solve those problems. So you can find it on iHeartRadio.
That's great. That sounds like, I love the Fix It in Five too. That's a great idea for a spin-off kind of a segment. And so when you're out these days, what are you looking for as far as opportunities for Carl? What type of things are you doing out there, Carl? You've got a lot of energy. You've got a lot of great ideas. You've got a lot of topics you can talk on. Are you looking for speaking gigs to business owners? Are you consulting besides selling books and doing radio shows? What else are you up to these days?
Right on. So yeah, we're still do our coaching and consulting as we have. So what's interesting to me right now is getting back out into the speaking world. I've done hybrid and virtual events, of course, but small events are coming back. Larger events will be back later in the year. I'm looking for speaking engagements and how I can help somebody make their event their best ever. And I'm also an investor, so I'm looking for other business opportunities, and I'm looking for businesses to buy and invest in. Our business is kind of like that show, The Profit, with Marcus Lemonis, where we will come in and invest in a company, help them either grow it or turn it around, or some combination of the two, and provide a management team to help them do that. So we're very much in the market for opportunities that are like that.
Now, I have a website for you. It's 7stageadvisors.com. Lots of information there, lots of great ways to get in touch with Carl and work with 7Stage Advisors. Learn about the book, learn about the radio show. There are no shortage of ways to learn about what you're up to, and you share your knowledge in many, many ways, and we really appreciate you sharing with our listeners today, Carl, and coming onto the show once again. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate you having me again, and thanks for having me back. It's great to be able to contribute to your listeners again.
Terrific. Thanks so much. So thank you for listening today. It's a real pleasure to have you with us. And I'm going to move on to my next guest, and she is Jennifer Catrulia. Jennifer is a partner at Citrin Cooperman and is considered a pioneer of the outsourced virtual CFO advisory and accounting services space. She's credited with helping hundreds of companies in all phases of growth implement best practices and position themselves for profitable and successful ROI at exit. And Jennifer's a nationally recognized strategic and operations advisor for high growth technology, service-based, and healthcare companies who are committed to choosing to achieve results over making excuses. Jennifer, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, Bill, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity.
My pleasure. Tell us a little bit about what you do, more about what you do at Citrin Cooperman, easy for me to say, and tell us a little bit about you and your background, Jennifer.
Absolutely. So I am a partner at Citrin Cooperman. I actually am a co-leader of our outsourced accounting and advisory group, which is rapidly growing and exciting, helping really businesses in the small and mid-sized market replace in-house accounting positions or supplement their positions or fully outsource their accounting team, and also provide strategic advisory, technology consulting, exit strategy support, and a range of other services. We're a top 25 firm in the country, so really have a broad range of capabilities from the small business up through enterprise side. I also get the great opportunity to help lead our national business development efforts, so really working with businesses across the country and love helping them move toward a great exit.
Your company's like a Swiss Army knife for businesses of all sizes. You do all kinds of things. You're a CPA, right? But you focus on helping companies as a chief operating officer or an operating partner, and or often as part of helping a company with their business development strategy. How did your career evolve and that's led you down all of these different paths?
Well, I come actually from a very entrepreneurial family, and so have been a part of businesses being built from startup to, multi-million dollar businesses and have shared the journey of businesses up through successful exit, but also the challenges. And I am, really glad that that's given me a very versatile skill set. And so helping companies scale, definitely those who are venture capital or private equity funded and are really hitting the gas hard. That's where I love coming in, helping with everything from the financial reporting and accounting to the operations and all of those things that start to crack and implode as you really put pressure on a company to grow and certainly move toward exit. Those are things that just experience through it, doing this dozens of times in my own life, but also with clients hundreds of times over the years, really has helped me find my sweet spot and what I love and super exciting.
Yeah, it's one day at a time, right? You've learned these different skill sets as you've probably been called into them by clients and realized, hey, they need more than just an accountant at this point. They need really overall help. What should a business owner or company do today, as many of our listeners are thinking about, if they know they want to build toward the optimal exit?
Well, it's really important to start to focus on best practices across the company and really think about what you'd be doing if you were going through due diligence now. So many companies will say, well, I have these few areas that are just kind of for culture or for company, morale, or I've overspent on marketing or I've done these other things. But once you create the environment in your company, two things happen. If you're allowing leaks in any of the areas of your best practices, whether that's technology or client service or HR, any of the areas of the company, you aren't actually maximizing your ROI today or preparing to do that at exit. But also, living as if you were going through due diligence now, even if it's several years out, best positions you to be ready both for the sales pitch and for that exit. It can be a big ship to turn if you're not building toward it over the years.
Now, most business owners I know think of that statement as like, well, what you're saying is kind of like pretend like I'm getting audited for taxes now. That's no fun. I don't want to do that. I want to think about growing the business, all the fun stuff, you know, just moving forward and multiplying the size of the business. But what you're saying is critically important, that if you are thinking about selling your business in the future and you don't know when that buyer might come along, you need to be ready for that. And it's better to start getting ready now, and you don't have to do it alone. You want to address that a little bit? I mean, a lot of people talk about creating a data room or a data file. So let's talk a little bit more about what that means, getting ready for that due diligence.
Well, so really right from the start, or as early on as reasonably possible, building that company that starts to accumulate the documentation, but also the best practices and the records going back several years, and also the forecasts looking forward about how the business is going to continue to grow and be successful and attractive to a potential buyer, really essentially creating your pitch deck that you continue to roll forward year over year that is ready for that opportunity that comes up. And again, is also kind of the scorecard for how the company is doing right now. Because one of the things I see all the time is that unexpected offer that comes up, or a shift in the company where somebody needs out unexpectedly or wants out, and the company just isn't positioned to do that. And certainly if they get that dream offer and due diligence begins, they lose it. And that can be so incredibly disappointing. So I think, always positioning as if you want to be ready for the opportunity when it strikes, I think is critically important. And so the data room and gathering records, having them easily accessible, making sure that financial records especially are ready to go and be picked apart really by a potential buyer, marketing information, et cetera, just doing an internal audit periodically to make sure you'd be ready to go, kind of a practice drill, can really help.
Great points. Thank you so much for that. I think that's very helpful for our listeners to hear. Here's one other thing I was wanted to get your opinion on. How important do you think it is for someone to work with someone like yourself and your firm to imagine and create a kind of desired wish list for what the offer should look like? In other words, a benchmark of here's what we're looking for exactly. And then that way, when an offer comes in, they can either decide either this is close and maybe it can be negotiated to a point of sale, or we should dismiss this right away and move on. Because I see a lot of time wasted on owners who get an offer and go down this rabbit hole, and there's some things that they stop running their business correctly. Do you see that too?
Absolutely. I think it's really important to consider the value of an outside advisor, certainly throughout the business. Those who are most successful generally will tell you that they have an outside coach or advisor or something like that. But I'll take that a step further in terms of, exit planning, is to kind of have a running valuation that's been calculated, independently. And I'm using that informally because that's something, for example, we do with our clients, is assess what that value is today, what the steps need to be in order to increase that value. It gives you a sense of where you stand in the market right now and the value of doing that outside of your company. There are several positives. The first is you can be in such a vacuum within the company that even if you feel like you're active out in the marketplace, someone in our firm, for example, is working with a number of different clients in that space. We're actually seeing what's happening across the market. We're, heavily invested in the continuing education, just things that really can't happen easily if you're inside your own company. So we have a perspective that isn't really available inside. Secondly, as we move toward this exit point, we are going to be more objective usually than the company is going to be internally. So we offer kind of that balance of being able to, not the bad cop, but the support system to keep a company closely aligned with the goals they shared with us early on and to help set new ones and keep things on track. And really, it's a scalable partnership. We have the team members that can come in and out of the company to participate as needed in whatever roles are needed, so that the company doesn't have to overspend on positions that may not need full time. But all of those things, again, just give perspective, some freshness throughout the scale and path to exit that a company has trouble retaining internally.
Great points. Again, really taking inventory on a lot of different areas, where your realistic value is, not what the value you think it is, but what is a financial model say it's worth, just so you know what the ballpark looks like. And then, again, a big part of it is, what are you going to be doing after you leave the business? Probably not working in the business very long, so you better start delegating a lot of your tasks early on and making sure the business runs without you. Great, great, great tips. What are you seeing company leaders do right now that you wish that you could change?
It's pull back, partially on what we were just talking about with getting that right outside advice. But especially over this last year, companies have of course, been very concerned about conserving cash, cutting expenses. And I think once you've had the opportunity, and now over the last year, most companies need to have done this, make sure that you feel clear about whatever your path is forward and your strategy for moving forward. And then it's time to accelerate again and really be pushing toward those goals, because whatever fear you may have, you have a competitor or more who are, moving forward and accelerating and spending on the outside help or the marketing and advertising or the other things to push forward and have proven to be agile. So now is not the time to shrink back and be quiet. And especially if you have sales teams, for example, who are out on the streets and who then are either restricted from social media or don't have the skill set to work virtually, there's a reasonable expectation that we're going to be in this hybrid model for a while. So I just think companies may have pivoted in terms of their belief that they have to push forward, but execution, if that's not happening as well, it will really continue to hold them back.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Now, one of the topics that you talk about is key differences between acquisitions that succeed and those that fail, because a lot of our listeners, too, are not only looking to be acquired, but they're also looking to acquire as part of their growth strategy towards sale. What are some of the problems that you see in acquisitions that cause them to fail?
The several months before the acquisition takes place, before the transaction is done, it's really important for the companies to work together as if the transaction has already been completed. Even if there's, I used to call it and still call it an acquisition incubator, really looking at how the alignment is going to happen, how the merger is going to happen, and moving forward with that in mind. So you work out the bugs in advance. And so just like any other, dating relationship, you find out that it's really going to work in practice. And I also think being really clear about what ownership, current company ownership after the acquisition is going to be doing, if they are, it's very common, of course, for the few years after the deal takes place, to have that continuity and to have those people in place. Now, are you going to be clear about all roles and responsibilities and benchmarks so that expectations are set up front and you're sure you're really rehearsing toward that point? And secondly, is making sure that the right teams will be in place to support the scale post-acquisition, because the friends and family, board of directors that you may have had, the internal team members who may be capped out based on the company's growth, there needs to be an analysis done across the company to make sure it can function as a bigger company.
Really good advice. I mean, a lot of owners think, well, we'll keep it a secret and we'll, all at once we'll spring it on everybody, but it's really important that the culture's the cultures mesh, right? I mean, that's a big point of contention for a lot of mergers that go wrong. Is they should have looked more at cult of the people and not so much at the numbers, perhaps. Do you concur
exactly
with that? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
When you're out looking at companies, and one of the things that you all do a lot is look for profit and efficiency leaks and dramatically improved performance. Is there a top three type of a list at things that you see regularly that you say, here we go again. It's we're seeing this profit and efficiency leak in the company, or is it just all over the board?
I would think, I think that three come up very commonly. The first is leadership, not realizing when they need more leadership support, when they have capped out of their current expertise and are kind of spinning their wheels and maybe spending money where it's not best utilized because they themselves need additional coaching, need additional growth support, and aren't bringing in the right advice. And part of that may relate to their accounting team, their HR, whatever the skill sets are in the company. Once they don't know anymore, it's important to, you know, the sayings about bringing in people who are smarter than you or have experiences you don't, you know, that's incredibly important. The second I would say is under-investing in technology and automation. And this, you know, how we've been doing it for years is okay. Well, you can end up spending a lot of money on human labor that isn't as efficient or as productive as technology, and really not being able to get the real-time results you need. And the third is keeping wonderful people around too long, meaning that the company may outgrow them, and it may need new skill sets either to raise up existing team members or to replace them. And that can be very hard to stomach and to manage, but it's really important for the survival and success of the company. And so planning ahead for that path out and how you can both be supportive of team members, but look at the growth and success of the company, that's something that should be addressed early on.
Very good. Thank you. And you talked about automation and technology. There are some companies that are saying, you know, we've gone virtual because of COVID. Now we're going to stay virtual or maybe pursue a hybrid model. What are some technology considerations for companies that are going to do that, stay virtual or pursue a hybrid model?
Well, I think a big one that is not specific to equipment, but is cybersecurity. So as everybody jumped home and onto their own devices and everything else, that's something that for a short period of time, companies had to turn a little bit away from and just get home. But I think now over the span of time, you know, many people are working off of individual computers still and mobile devices, et cetera. And so there have been a lot of breakdowns there that leave a lot of vulnerabilities. I think, you know, over time, it's going to be in terms of equipment upgrades and making sure everybody's on the same platforms and that they're working successfully. It's going to be a matter of looking at company policies about how things are upgraded and maintained and paid for. And really from a training and standpoint, now that we are using, everybody hopped into meeting solutions and into, you know, staying connected. But whether it was virtual etiquette that hasn't been addressed or successful selling and social selling in a virtual environment, really taking an inventory of what the new world, a new hybrid model will require and starting to check off those boxes. If companies haven't done it, now is really the time to shore that up.
Good point. Yeah, I think for a lot of people, COVID has really been a catalyst to push us into the next phase of communications and virtual running our business virtually. And again, if you don't do it as a business owner, you're going to be sorry because others are doing it in a big way. It's just incredible, the advances in technology. So let me ask you, you have something called an ROI Mastery Bootcamp, which starts March 22nd in 2021. What's that all about? Tell us how that works and who should attend.
Sure. So the ROI Mastery Bootcamp is really kind of the intro to, we have an ROI Mastery program and community, but the bootcamp is essentially a 9-day, so over 2 weeks, it's an hour a day. We break down best practices in a growing company into 9 areas, and we spend an hour a day together talking about the best practice areas. It's very interactive. We want to take questions. I have open office hours for people to jump into and attend. So really an extension of what we're talking about today is looking at each of the areas of a company and optimizing success in those areas. And we offer a scorecard and homework. But really the opportunity to, over a 9-day intensive period, give a company a chance to really look at all those areas and score themselves and see where there are needs for improvement. And then through the ongoing program, if they choose to, certainly focus on those areas in the longer term and be part of a community.
Well, here's something for our listeners. You're offering anybody who contacts you on LinkedIn or emails you at jcatrulia. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Did I get that right, or am I
Absolutely.
Butchering it?
Yes.
Okay.
No,
J K A T R U L Y A. I like it because it's got Truly right in the middle of it. JKATRULYA at Citrin Cooperman, and that's CITRIN Cooper, MAN, Cooperman, .com. If you get in touch with Jennifer there or find her on LinkedIn, you'll receive a complimentary ROI Mastery Best Practices ebook and an invitation to join their next ROI Mastery Bootcamp, which again starts March 22nd. Again, we're in 2021. So that's all great, and that sounds like a really, really good thing for somebody to do these days, to really start focusing on a lot of these points. Jennifer, you really brought it home today. You gave us a lot of great tips, and I really appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners do too. If you are wondering more about what the company does, go to their website, Citrin Cooperman, again, C-I-T-R-I-N, Cooperman.com, and find out more about what they do. They have a lot of locations, but you're talking to one of their best people right now, or you're listening to, that's Jennifer Cotrulia. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Bill, you too. Thanks so much.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please hang with us.
You're listening to one of many shows on ExitCoachRadio.com. We're interviewing advisors, authors, and thought leaders for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. If you'd like to be a guest on any of our shows, go to guest.ExitCoachRadio.com. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute. You're listening to one of many shows on ExitCoachRadio.com. We're interviewing advisors, authors, and thought leaders for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. If you'd like to be a guest on any of our shows, go to guest.ExitCoachRadio.com. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
You're listening to ExitCoachRadio.com, the information station for age 50-plus business owners, where we're interviewing top advisors for their best tips, ideas, and precautions so you can be well-planned. We upload new one-minute tips every day. ExitCoachRadio.com. Come listen for a minute.
Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for joining me today. Always a pleasure to have you with me. My next guest is Doug C. Brown, and he's with Business Success Factors, and they're a consulting, coaching, and training company that helps companies to increase their sales revenue growth. And we're going to talk today about 10 ways your company can expand its revenue. We may not be able to get to all 10, but we're going to give it a try here, Doug. So welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on here.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Tell us a little bit more about you and your background and Business Success Factors before we get into those top 10.
Well, I started working when I was the age of 3 for my dad's business, and I was sweeping floors, right? So I started from the ground up. I've gone on to build over 35 companies at this point. Not all succeeded. Some, you know, definitely did not, and some broke even, and some were quite successful. So what led me to here was in one of my last companies that I was actively doing, the business led us into kind of supporting training companies. And so the first one I supported was a man named Jay Conrad Levinson from Guerrilla Marketing. Then he introduced me to a man named Chet Holmes. And I, for about 5 years or so, I did the independent sales, president of sales and training with Chet Holmes. And then I ended up doing it for Tony Robbins, for Russ Whitney. We've worked with a bunch of, you know, brand names, you know, whether it's Deepak Chopra, Brian Tracy, any of those, you know, names. And I was the guy behind the scenes helping them to expand their revenue.
Awesome. Okay, so you've got a lot of experience with a lot of great names there, and 35 companies started. You've learned a thing or two a day at a time, I would imagine, over the last several years. So today we want to talk about the 10 ways your company can expand its revenue. You want to just click us off in David Letterman style?
Number one. Yeah, for sure. So he always starts from the top down, right? The top 10. So I'll just go through them. I mean, look, the number one is acquisition of new clients, you know, increasing the number of new clients. Because, you know, and this is the one that most companies are very myopically focused on. And they need to have some, you know, certainly some focus on it. So number two would be increasing how much that the client actually buys through the transactional value. So increasing the actual purchase at the time of purchase. Number three, increasing the frequency of how they buy. You know, how frequently do they buy, I should say. So, you know, if you can get them to buy more often, then you'll increase your revenue. Number four, you want to increase the effectiveness of the actual purchase. And so what that means is you want to close the loops on anything to help move the purchase along. Number five is to speed up the purchase. How do you speed up the sale? Because if you can speed up the sale, then you have more time to do additional things, such as prospecting.
Sure.
Number six was to increase the efficiency of the purchase. So one, you know, being the effectiveness, how do we actually sell more? And the other being, how do we actually sell more efficiently? Number seven, increasing the human capital. Number eight, increasing the overall retention rate of the clients. Next one was increasing the margins and prices of what we're selling. That'll not only increase the revenue, but it'll increase the profitability. And then followed up, I think we're on number 10, which is increasing meaningful communications on the internal and external side of the business.
Very good.
Those are your top 10.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. No, I'm just kidding. That was great. You, you went through those pretty quickly, and I wrote them all down. So I think some of them really bear repeating. Like for instance, I don't think, and maybe you agree with me, maybe you won't, but I don't think anybody does a better job these days at increasing a purchase than Vistaprint. Have you ever bought a business card or anything?
I have.
You know, they make you go through about 10 upsell opportunities because they want you to leave with a mouse pad and a coffee cup and a sticker for your car and all kinds of things. What are some other examples of companies that increase purchases and how can or what are some tips you have for our listeners?
Well, I think GoDaddy is another good example of that. If anybody's ever worked with GoDaddy. Right, you call into GoDaddy, you want to get a domain. Before you know it, they've got you into a website program, email, private domain registration, hosting. Right, they're constantly trying to either upsell, cross-sell, or sometimes even downsell. So in the increasing the transactional value side, it's either we want them to buy something more expensive, if you will, or more costly. Or we want to sell them items, you know, if you go into Best Buy, you know, or something like that, they'll try to, if they're any good at it, they'll, you know, you buy a camera, they want you to buy a bag, memory cards, extended warranties, anything that
right.
is related to the sale that is a cross-sell. Or a downsell, let's say you go in and you want a camera, and it's like you really want the $2,000 camera, but you're just not really there. One of the mistakes that companies make all the time is they let people leave without getting anything. And so they would be much better off if they had, hey, listen, you know what? We have this, it doesn't matter, $29 education program on how to buy cameras, whatever it is. Because that first step called a downsell gets engagement from the client, and now we're building trust. But a lot of times people will let these people walk out their door. I see this happen a lot in retail, but I mean, it definitely happens in corporate as well, you know, on B2B sales.
Right, right. And these days for people that aren't completely virtual, which, you know, most people are virtual, but I hear this a lot, is that your consumer is coming in. Let's say you're selling cars, for instance. Your consumer is not coming in to look at the cars. They've looked at the cars. They know about the cars. They've researched it online. So your salespeople have to be asking different and better questions to get them engaged in other different ways, right?
Without question, because the information transfer now, years ago, the seller had all the information. If you went to buy a car, you didn't know hardly anything. You might have read a magazine or something like that, but there was no internet, right? So the internet has leveled the playing field, where now the buyer actually has more information than the seller on the products or services. And
right.
So the sales conversation changes at this point. It's much more about building rapport and to understand that the buyer doesn't need, unless it's, you're the one person that's selling, the magic pill, and that's it. They don't need to come to you. So the question now is, instead of it being a top-down sale, it's got to be a rapport win-win basis sale. And it's funny, because the other night I my refrigerator at my home was making noise, and I'm like, oh, I got to get a new refrigerator, right? And I do what most consumers do. I go online, I start looking at it, okay, this Maytag or GE or whatever it might be. And I'm like, okay, well, heck, you know what? I'll go to Lowe's, because Lowe's is right down the street from me, number one. And number two, I'm a veteran, so they give me 10% discount, right? So I'm like, no problem, I'll go down there. And I walk into the place, and I go up into the appliance side, and I say to the gentleman, hey, listen, I'm looking for a new refrigerator. He asked me, what type? I say, well, I'm looking at these models. And now I'm asking questions. Does this one use more electricity than this one? Type things. And he's like, I don't know. And I'm saying, I already have the information, you know what I mean? Because just like most consumers, you can find almost everything that one needs to be able to make a purchasing decision. And I think I just saw a stat yesterday that said in business to business, over 50% of the people now, before they make a buying decision, are actually going to the internet to actually find something, whether credibility on the person selling or the product or service information. And with consumers, it's even higher than that. So the whole game of selling and doing transactional type process is diminished. And it's really about now selling on value, and that value is what is the value to the end buyer, because they don't need a seller anymore, not in most cases, unless it's a very complex sale. Right?
Well, yeah, a good point, because consumers, they're not new at this anymore. They're not new at using the interview. I remember, back in 1990, I was going to go traveling, and I looked at I went on the internet, and I'm like, hey, what is all this? And who put all this stuff on here? I was impressed, but I was new at it. Nowadays, it's second nature, and companies like, of course, Amazon have made it just really easy, because you're going to get it in a day or two. You don't have to worry about the lag time. Customers are expecting more and more. What's the number one mistake that you see companies making with their sales that impede or stop their growth, Doug?
Ooh, number one, there's so many. But the number one, I think, that I see most commonly is, well, I would say these two are equal. Number one is they're neglecting their past or dormant buyers. Right? So they sell them. They're in their database. They might send them an email here and there, or they might send them something. But they're not engaging with their past client base, because most of them think, well, they already purchased. They're not really good for, a repurchase. But in the reality is, one of the first things I do when I go to a company and we do an assessment, do the audit, and do the interviews, we inevitably find this, that they have a whole bunch of money sitting there in their past clients that they can just go back and mine. And that, that could be a phone call. I had a company that were doing $4 million, and we just did this for 2 weeks. They went back and they engaged their old client base, which they said was dead. Some of the stuff they said was, 4 years old. And they got $300,000 of new sales out of the old client base with zero marketing cost.
Yes.
Right? So And the second, go ahead, sir.
I would put that in the category, first of all, sorry to interrupt, but of not looking at that long-term value of a customer, right? That they think one and done or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, they teach lifetime value in all the business courses, but, you know, when it comes to entrepreneurs, many of them are just so myopically focused on getting new clients, they're forgetting about the LTV, the lifetime value of that particular client. Now, the thing that people are not actually getting, even though, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars in sales is nice, but when they go back and they reengage, some of the clients have said, geez, I've been missing you, right? I've been right? My brother actually needs what you need. So now they're starting to pick up referrals out of that old dormant client base that they would have never had. So now they're expanding the sale just from one facet of going back and reengaging old clients.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really good point. And, you know, let's face it, in this day and age where everything's automated, it's one thing if you say blue curtains, and all of a sudden on your phone it's popping up with pictures of blue curtains from Amazon. You know, we have all had that happen these days. But it's different if you have a relationship with an interior decorator and you really miss that connection. And, you know, a lot of people are missing connection these days, aren't they?
Statistics show that quality of life is actually more important to people in getting a job today than the actual money they make, especially when it comes to sales, the quality of life. So that connection that you're speaking about goes to, in my opinion, to the quality of their life. And the fact that we've been in a pandemic and the economic struggles that have been going on and people have been sheltering in place, they're craving connection more than ever. And just in simple little ways, right? I mean, we don't have to do big, gigantic things. I mean, for the first time in, I think it's 4.5 months, I went to a restaurant with my family. And, you know, we sat down. But just the fact that I got to speak with the person who was serving us and talk with the front person on the, I mean, it was like, wow, a whole new world, right? Because we haven't had it. But, yes, people now are craving connection more than ever. And they're finding it now through, you know, other mediums like the, you know, video conferencing or, you know, Zoom or
yes.
whatever they might be doing. I mean, you know, they're even doing like video dating is a big thing going on now, right? But there's nothing
right.
replaces
right.
the connection between human and to human interaction. And, you know, the being in person is even a higher quality than that usually than over video.
Unless it's a Lowe's salesman that says, I don't know. Right. Effective communication.
Well,
right.
You know, exactly. And here's the really weird thing about that, right? I would have expected them to know some of the basic stuff, but they're not well trained in that particular area or that individual didn't learn about that. That gave me enough doubt to say, you know what? Home Depot's not too far away. And I got an appliance, you know, warehouse not too far away, and I've got another place not too far away. So I'm like, okay, I better look. And I'm typically a guy that goes in and says, I know what I want, but he created enough ambiguity in the thought process of his responses created ambiguity in my head. He didn't create anything. I did, which I said, you know what? I feel a little uncomfortable here. And so since I didn't feel comfortable, now I'm looking at competitors where Lowe's would have had that, you know, whatever the heck it was, $1,500 sale or whatever it was at the time.
That's a great segue into another question I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, these days when a business owner, one of our listeners wants to sell their business, they find that they're in an ever-expanding beauty contest, right? It's not very rarely, and I hear this a lot, I'm sure you do too, that private equity groups or financial buyers of businesses, they're generally not looking at one business. They're looking at 10 businesses. They're looking at 20 businesses to find the one that, and there's a lot out there. There's a lot for sale. So what would you say, you know, what can our listeners do to start working on their sales and revenue growth so that they can be attractive in that beauty contest?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. They are looking at numerous companies. You know, that's why they call them portfolio companies. You know, they're looking at all these portfolios, and they're trying to find the diamond in the rough, right? Because if they invest, they typically want somewhere between 6 and 15+% not percent, but X return, right? That's what they're looking for, most of the companies like this. So, look, the more profitable a company is, the more attractive they're going to be. The more a company has systematic sales processes and systematic customer journey processes all the way through, from, you know, marketing aligned with sales, aligned with operations, aligned with customer service, you know, all the way through, and it should go back to the marketing or sales channel at that point to regenerate a new sale. The more that they have that, that the more attractive they're going to be. So if they want to grow their revenues, the first thing they must do, they got to audit where they are. Well, no, let me back up. The first thing they got to do is they got to get really truthful about, are they committed to actually growing to the levels that they say they are? You know, because a lot of companies will come and they'll say, you know, I want to grow by X million dollars or X percent. But then when we start digging in, we find out that that's not the true number. And the challenge with that is they'll spend monies that they don't have to. They'll do effort they won't have to do if they were just truthful. You know, as long as they're growing, they'll be attractive to, in most cases, be attractive to a buyer. The second thing they want to do is then do an audit of where they are. Let's do a real assessment of what do we have. Because we've got to have big grand ideas, but if we find out we have all these constraining factors that are going to stop us from getting there and we don't clear those constraining factors first, and we end up dumping marketing money and all kinds of things into it, you know, it could actually hurt the company more than help the company. So what we do is we go in, we get help them get truthful, do an audit on the company. Then we do interviews with the people, because you might find things in the people side that you don't find in the process side, if you will. And so once we do the interviews, we might even have to assess people. You know, if they have a sales team, for example, and they're not really hitting quota every single month, maybe they're in the wrong position, right? Maybe they're not a hunter of sales process. So once we do that thing, then that's when you build the growth plan, because you know all the constraining factors, you know what you have for assets, what you're going to need for assets if you need to go out and get some, and then build the plan from there. That's the process of what I take my clients through anyway.
That's great. Great information. Really great tips for our listeners. We got the, you know, we got the top 10 list out of the way early. That was good. I really enjoyed the conversation with you, and I hope you'll come back and share more tips with our listeners in the future. I want to tell our listeners that they can get a sales and marketing checklist from you by sending an email to YouMatter, the word YouMatter altogether, at businesssuccessfactors.com. YouMatter at businesssuccessfactors.com. What is that? What are they going to get there, Doug? What is that going to look like, and why should somebody do that?
So it's a first initial assessment. So if you basically, it'll have a series of questions all around your sales and marketing, and it'll punch holes where their holes should be, and it will reveal blind spots that they're having within their company. So they'll be able to rate how are they doing, you know, gauged against, you know, companies who are doing, you know, consistently well, how are they gauging up against those? And they'll find out, you know, it's usually a pretty eye-opening thing where they go, okay, well, we're good here, but we're deficient here. And that's really what the checklist is all about, the design. So it's a quick way of them being able to say, okay, whoa, all right, we can grow, but we have these constraining factors, or we have these things going on. Or we have these things not going on, and therefore we need to do this.
Excellent. Always good to hear good tips and help people take inventory. And it sounds like you have a great thing going there for business owners, and I hope our listeners will get in touch. Again, go to businesssuccessfactors.com, or if you want to get that checklist, YouMatter, send an email to YouMatter at businesssuccessfactors.com. To receive it. Doug, thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. As I said before, hope you come back and join us again.
I'd be happy to. You're a great interviewer, and I really appreciate the questions you've asked and having me on here.
Thank you kindly. All right, have a great day.
You too.
Thanks,
sir,
for joining us. We've had a great show today. Great group of guests. Hope you enjoyed it. And that's going to do it for today's Exit Coach Radio. Hope you'll join us again soon for another edition.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.